580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today at WILL AM 580. We're going to be talking the internet again, the digital revolution, where we're going. And we're going to have as our guest one of the really outstanding experts on the matter, Yochai Benkler, professor of law at Harvard University, will be joining us today to talk about the wealth of networks and where we're going. Should be a wonderful show, but before we get to our guests, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
Early next year, the Supreme Court will hear a case that could impact the effectiveness of the Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA, by determining how much information a corporation is required to make public. The case evolved out of a Federal Communications Commission investigation into allegations by Comtel, an association of small telephone carriers, that AT&T overcharged the FCC's universal service site in New London, Connecticut. The USF currently ensures that communities have access to subsidized phone services. The FCC asked AT&T to produce its records as part of its investigation. AT&T complied with the request and paid a sum of money to settle the case without admitting liability. Comtel then filed a request under FOIA to obtain information related to the FCC's role in the administrative irregularities in the case. AT&T objected to giving the information, arguing it would harm its personal privacy. AT&T appealed in federal court and won. The FCC is now asking for that decision to be reviewed at the High Court. The case is slated to be heard on January 19th, and this week, Free Press filed an amicus brief in the case. Policy counsel for Free Press, Aparna Sridhar, explains that although there are provisions for sensitive information like trade secrets and individual personal information, FOIA has a blanket mandatory disclosure of agency records.
Under the FOIA, there's no such thing as a corporate right to personal privacy under this exemption.
If corporations could assert a privacy interest under this particular provision, Sridhar says, the information about all kinds of enforcement proceedings could be withheld from public disclosure.
And that's really problematic for us because we need that disclosure, one, to figure out whether or not companies are malefactors, two, to figure out whether the FCC is going after bad guys, and three, to figure out how best to advocate for better policy at the FCC based on what they are or aren't doing.
Sridhar says that the kind of right the court is reviewing is one that is fundamental to persons, and that distinguishes it from other rights that the court has previously granted to corporations.
Spectrum reform may not sound like the sexiest technology news topic of the year, but there seems to be agreement across the board, from wireless carriers to consumer advocates, that some form of it is necessary. And President Obama agrees. This summer, he called on the National Telecommunications and Information Administration and the Federal Communications Commission to free up 500 megahertz of spectrum for broadband use in the next 10 years. This week, the NTIA released its roadmap on how to get there. Benjamin Lennett is the senior policy analyst for the Open Technology Initiative at the New America Foundation. He explains that in addition to identifying portions of the spectrum that could be reallocated, the NTIA report also outlines several proposals to get the federal government to be more efficient spectrum users.
So right now, the federal government, these include, the Department of Defense and the Forestry Department and so forth, has access to a considerable amount of spectrum, much of which goes unused at various times because, you don't always have forest fires, or DOD, uses it for radar in some geographic areas, but it's completely unused in others. And so it's very underutilized. And so there's been a continued push by the wireless carriers such as AT&T and T-Mobile and Verizon to get more spectrum on the market.
But even though the report is out, it doesn't necessarily mean that anything will happen soon.
The unfortunate reality is that a lot of what's in the report has been, you know, said and put on the table for the past decade almost, of creating better incentives for federal users, of facilitating sharing, of all the rhetoric is really much the same. And unfortunately, I think until you start seeing some leadership really from the president, and really it becomes sort of a national push to really reform not just sort of how they allocate spectrum to federal users, but how the federal government handles its communications and how each, you know, each department, each federal agency actually handles its communications, I don't think you're going to get very far because, you know, each of them, when they're asked, each agency says, oh, we're using it. And there's very little transparency with respect to actually what they're using it for. And there's ways to sort of open up the data without compromising security, but that kind of stuff is not even on the table at this point.
For Lennett, spectrum reform offers up an important moment to push for new opportunities that will benefit consumers and communities. To learn more about spectrum policy issues, visit oti.newamerica.net.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today of November 21st, 2010, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today has been called by none other than Larry Lessig as maybe the most important communication scholar of our times. And his book, The Wealth of Networks, has become a classic work in understanding the Internet, published 4 years ago by Yale University Press. It's my great pleasure to welcome to Media Matters today Yochai Benkler from Harvard Law School. Yochai Benkler, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks very much. It's wonderful to get a chance to chat.
It really is. And, you know, let's start. Your book, The Wealth of Networks, I think, as I said, has become sort of a classic work that everyone who's serious about understanding the Internet and the debates about the Internet and where it's going has to go through. And let's just sum up some of the key points you make in there, and then we'll take a broad range of issues concerning the Internet that might come up and let our callers participate. But why the title, The Wealth of Networks? What were you getting at with the title, and what's the point, therefore, of the book?
So, first of all, thank you for the extremely kind reference. It's rare for someone when we write to get a sense that people read and enjoy. But the reference, obviously, to Adam Smith is the obvious with Wealth of Nations, and the core claim is that a set of technological changes has made it practical for non-market behavior like Wikipedia, like open source software, to move from something that was very important socially in the home, among friends and neighbors, but not important economically in the industrial economy, from the periphery of the economy to its very core. And as a consequence of that change, really shifting many of the core information and cultural industries we care about, having an effect on cultural production, having an effect on news, having an effect on participation in the democratic public sphere. And so it's that combination of, on one hand, a technological economic change that allows new forms of production to play an important role at the very core of the information economy, together with the political, social, cultural implications that come when you shift from an industrial model of information and cultural production to one that has a substantially larger role for social production.
Yochai Benkler, inspired by your work, Professor Juliet Shore, who's been on the show recently to discuss her new book, Plenitude, argues, and I think following up on some of the points you're just making, that given the information revolution, we're in a position now where small-scale enterprise and decentralized enterprise is not only competitive with the large corporate industrial enterprise of the last century, but is actually more efficient and will basically trump the large corporate enterprise, industrial enterprise. Is that a fair extension of your work?
It's a fair potential path. There are components there that I would want to question a little bit more deeply. So one question is the degree of determinism with which we see this trajectory. I am very much not a determinist. I think that things are very much still up for grabs. I think that the tension between decentralized small-scale models of production and innovation and creativity relative to increasingly powerful, even new entities like Google, like Facebook, creating components of the platform that make it harder rather than easier for distributed small-scale startups, makes it still open and a question. But certainly, if you look at some of the core sectors, if you look at software, obviously, what was up until 20 years ago thought to be the domain of large companies and large companies only. Clearly today, a very large role for small-scale entrepreneurial firms, and more surprisingly, obviously, non-market, non-firm-based model from open-source software. If you look at musicians, one of the most interesting examples of decentralized, autonomous business and cultural activity is what we're seeing today with artists who are freeing themselves from the extremely onerous recording industry deals and setting up on their own, on the net, using their own websites, using Facebook, using MySpace, distributing their music, creating a relatively small but intensely committed set of fans who then follow them and go to their shows and actually, with a new study that we just did, actually are willing to pay money, even when they're not forced to pay money, but rather download files and pay at least as much as they pay under the more coercive system, but the artists obviously get more. So there are real models along multiple domains in which this works, but the future is very far from determined.
Let me just follow up on that music, because that's a very interesting point you just raised. We had on the show about 6 months ago Jared Lanier, the author of You Are Not a Gadget, and he's a musician in addition to being a computer scientist. And he describes the fate of creative people in general on the internet as being, I think what his term was, the new peasants or digital peasants, in terms of not having a way to be compensated for their labor. How successful do you think what you're finding now with musicians being able to bypass the big companies and establish a form of commercial support directly through Facebook or some other internet mechanism? Is this something that's going to be a niche thing from what you can tell, or is this, in your view, something that has the potential to develop legs and actually become a way to support a substantial number of working musicians?
So let's back up and remember where we come from.
Okay.
We don't come from a place... We don't come from a place where musicians have a stable, well-understood pathway to making money. We come from a place in which the vast majority of musicians are starving artists. If you're talking classical or jazz, there's no way that musicians have actually been able to make money from a royalty-based model. People perform if they're depending on the space on the kind of music they play in something that is more philanthropically supported, like classical, something that's more performance based, like jazz. For the vast majority of musicians, even working in rock and pop, the one domain where there were at least some people genuinely making money from royalties, for the vast majority of people, the baseline contract left them almost nothing. It was primarily extracted by the recording industry, leaving the artists with the fun and excitement and recognition, which they then could translate into performance. So let's start with the understanding that the baseline is that the majority, and when I say the majority, I mean on the order of 98% of artists did not make money from royalties. So if that's what you need to displace, it's not that high of a bar. Now let's look at what the new findings are in a piece that I'm coming up with several of my former students. We looked at sites. The particular approach is the one that publicly has been seen with Radiohead, with Trent Reznor and Nine Inch Nails, of taking music and making it available online in both free and non-free download versions. I'm not talking about explicit donation, although some of them are, but rather making it available and allowing people to pay, but without imposing strict copyright restrictions. So many of these are delivered under Creative Commons license, without creating technological mechanisms supported by the Digital Millennium Copyright Act or DRM protection, so that it's legal and feasible for people to make copies, but it's also easy for them to pay. And what we find is that because the artist is able to maintain all of the revenue except for the maintenance of the site, it doesn't take a very large portion of the audience to pay before the artist is making more from downloads than they would otherwise make. So let's just take even a failed experiment.
Okay.
So if you take a failed or what was reported as a failed experiment the first time Trent Reznor came out with something that was called Niggy Tardust, and that was reported as a failure because something on the order of 18 to 20% of downloaders paid. But then when you actually look at the average payment relative to what it was that the most recently then available deal for the same artists was through the industry, the artists on this failed deal made more than twice as much as what as their share of the royalties was on the successful earlier release. Then when you move forward, the same artists after the failure go forward and release Ghosts 1 to 4, then you're already looking at returns of on the order of $1.6 million for the first week, and you're really talking about massive stardom on the old model with the artists being able to keep a lot. One of the things we did was actually look not at these major people who had already made their name in the traditional industry, but looking at people who could make rather than a new peasant class, the one term that I've heard from at least one artist describing it is a new middle class. That is to say, instead of being always working for the major industry, creating a set of stable contributors. And so there, what we found was looking at 3 to 5 years of data, is that people, so for one artist, for example, about 22%, and she actually designed it, this is Jane Sibbery, she's a Canadian artist, she designed it in a way that was the least likely to induce payment in the sense that it provided all sorts of ways for people to feel okay about downloading the music without paying, and made it very easy not to pay. And yet 22% paid, and those 22% paid $1.25 per download, which was a quarter, 25% more than the industry standard of the iTunes 99-cent download, leaving her with more by far than she would have gotten for iTunes downloads. We looked at somebody like Jonathan Colton, who's in that regard more of a leading-edge artist because former geek with a very geeky following, so people who are relatively more comfortable within the framework, again, providing all of the downloads under Creative Commons license so that it's legal to copy in perfectly available formats so that it's technically feasible to copy in a platform that really engages users forefront the user's own mashups so that the users become co-creators of this of cultural meaning of the songs with the artists, gets the fans themselves to organize appearances so they say we will show up at a certain point, becomes very closely connected to his fan base. And I think most artists working in the traditional system would be more than happy to have his returns on downloads, even though they are, for all practical purposes, voluntary. I see that as sustainable and feasible precisely because we didn't go off the big names who were experimenting, but off the people who were starting from the periphery and who didn't need perfect compliance. The structure of the deal was sufficiently good for the artist that humanly feasible levels of participation rather than perfect compliance was enough to help them make a living in combination with the other things they need to do and which they've always needed to do, which is performing and selling merchandise and things that pop and rock artists have always done.
Our guest today, who you've just been listening to, is Professor Yochai Benkler from the Harvard Law School, author of The Wealth of Networks, and also the co-director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society based at Harvard. We're talking about the Internet, its future, its prospects, what's going on there. It's a wide-ranging conversation. If you have any questions or comments, the number here at WILL-AM 580 is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. And Professor Benkler, before we go on to a number of other issues I want to talk about, I want to conclude on the issue of music here. And currently, the conventional music industry is dominated by four companies globally. And there are rampant rumors that soon to be three companies globally with mergers that are being negotiated and discussed that sell the vast majority of music both in the United States and around the world. By your argument, there's really no productive role for these guys, I assume, and these guys also don't want to give up their power. How is this going to play out?
The recording industry is the most successful at extracting all of the value from both the artists and the fans. 10 years ago, its revenue per employee was double the revenue per employee of the software industry or even Hollywood. But it extracted that value by perfecting its model around this one thing, which is you put music in units and you sell units with high monopoly rents or oligopoly rents. That model is dead. It's not at all clear from what we've seen that this industry has anything left useful to do. And of all of the industries, I wouldn't say this about news, I wouldn't say this about movies, I certainly wouldn't say this about software or all sorts of other things. The music industry itself was both superb at a particular historical, at extracting rents from a particular historical technological moment, and largely unnecessary going forward. So they'll continue to try to extract rents, and I suspect that most artists will find ways around them, and maybe they'll stay keeping a very small segment of the super artists who are recognized by millions of people, but they'll play a much more marginal role in the overall music world, but not before causing a good bit of damage in regulation and technology around them.
Yochai Benkler, one of the things you do in The Wealth of Networks that is especially impressive and useful for people who are new to the area is you explain the difference between information economics and traditional commodity economics of physical goods or services. Would you mind us giving us a 30 or 60 second summary of sort of the key differences that are crucial to understand why what's happening with music is different than what's happening with hamburgers?
With pleasure. So the basic economics of atoms, in this basic economics 101, we know whether this piece of wood should go to be making a chair or making a mallet based on the comparative prices for the two things. If we have enough mallets, then the demand for the wood will be relatively low and the demand for the chair will be higher, and somebody who will be willing to pay for it for the chair will pay more than someone for the mallet. And you can't use the wood both for the mallet and for the chair. So we know that when the wood is used for a chair because the person making the chair was willing to pay more, that's more efficient. That's absolutely critical to understanding the economics of Athens and scarcity. The same is not true for a novel, a piece of music. Tolstoy doesn't need to sit and write War and Peace again and again for the millionth or 10 millionth or 100 millionth reader. This is called non-rivalry. What it means is that the efficient price, in the same sense that we just talked about the wood, the efficient price for information goods like software, like books, like music is zero. Whenever we have a price that's higher than zero, we're doing it because we want to give people incentives to produce it to begin with, but we know that we're creating some inefficient market. The second problem is that information is both an input and an output of its own production. You create new stories from old stories, new pieces of music from recombination of prior pieces of music, new pieces of software from older pieces of software, and the higher the price is of an information good so as to create incentives for the past, the more expensive and inefficient it is for a second generation innovator to use the first generation. So we lose both efficiency of who enjoys and can use the materials today, not being willing to pay the rent, being willing to pay the actual economic cost, which is their own attention, but not the rent, and the second generation innovators, and this is the big deal. The second generation innovators, the makers of the equivalent of the mallets and the chairs, are paying an inefficiently high price, and we're losing these second generation innovations. So copyright, patent have always been a trade-off between, on one hand, wanting to give creators some incentive to produce, but recognizing that any price above zero is inefficient and undermining to innovation. And getting that price closest to zero as we can without undermining the first generation creation in order to enable the second generation creation has been the hard problem that information economics has been around. And at the moment, on the net, everything is information economics.
Yeah, I must say, Professor Benkler, someone who teaches us, that was one of the best explanations I've heard of the issue ever. That was really outstanding. Thank you for doing that. And let's talk about what that means for copyright. You've laid out the problem. You want to have your copyright protect that first generation, but you do not want the cost to be one bit more than it need be to society. So ideally, copyright would not be onerous. What has happened to copyright law in the last 30 or 40 years in the United States, and where does it stand right now?
So copyright law, some level of copyright law is useful and productive and has been quite important in many, many domains. The problem is that copyright law has a really quirky political economy. The people who benefit from having rights know that benefit immediately. The people who one day will have to pay excessive costs because they will write a novel 15 years from now, or they will create a mashup 18 months from now, don't know that they're suffering the costs of increased copyright. So they're not at the negotiating table. What's happened really since the mid-60s and on is that the recording industry and Hollywood have had a very powerful seat at the table, continuously ratcheting up copyright protection, initially in the 1976 Act, and most dramatically in the mid-90s. What happened in the early 90s was that these two industries saw, on one hand, enormous opportunity. The idea that they could control every single instance in use because you could actually track what people were doing with the music or the video. So now, if somebody wanted to watch something once, they could pay one price. If they wanted to watch it three times, they could pay another price. If they liked three other things, they could be charged a different price. You could have much finer-grained price discrimination as long as you could control the digital goods. So that was the big promise for the industry. On the other hand, there was a big threat, the threat that we now know as Napster or peer-to-peer sharing, which is they saw it as one big, giant digital copyright machine. And for them, the solution to avoiding the dystopia and reaching the utopia was exactly the same solution. Make sure that digital information is perfectly protected and encoded so that no one can crack it and make a copy, and at the same time, it can very, very carefully be monitored by the industry. They then undertook a campaign that began with the Clinton administration and a series of white papers anchored in the Commerce Department, moving on to Congress, where they failed in 96, to an internet, and then again brought it back in 98. And 1998 was a year of massive expansion of copyright. Copyright used to be criminal only toward commercial people who were stamping millions of CDs. Criminalization got extended to anyone who makes copies that are commercial with commercial basic or for commercial advantage, meaning also exchanging it freely with friends. So it suddenly became a private consumer potential criminal behavior. Most importantly, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. In 1998, Congress passed that essentially started to regulate technology development if that technology could undermine the digital wrappers that the industry was beginning to put their materials within. So you had a massive expansion of copyright in 1998 before many of the more innovative network-based firms even understood that they were going to be regulated by Hollywood and the recording industry, the law passed. What's happened in the last 12 years is a bit of a regulatory impasse. We've gotten to a very extreme version of copyright, but companies like Google, like IBM, began to understand that they were being regulated by the needs of Hollywood and the recording industry and that their innovation spaces were being filled. Traditional nonprofits and NGOs that used to be focused on media concerns but didn't really get that copyright was the next thing in the mid-90s started to see it. So you got the emergence of new groups like Public Knowledge. Obviously, Free Press is playing a role in this. Aligned with some of these technology firms succeeding in blocking further expansion. So we reached something of an impasse. In turn, the industry is now going to the international trade arena and trying to sneak through a new piece of treaty, trade treaty, ACTA, the anti-counterfeiting treaty, which will again extend copyright and American-style copyright law to many other countries. So the battle continues with the industry scared that its world is changing, trying to get ever stronger control over these technologies so they don't rock the boat. And on the other hand, the public interest community on one hand and the entrepreneurial innovative firms on the other trying to push back and say, this is our cultural environment. You're setting up fences everywhere, left, right, center, on the sidewalk, on your own property. You're setting up fences everywhere. Let us create. Let us create technology. Let us create a common culture. And that battle is still very much joined, and we're very far from knowing who is going to win.
Where does the iPod and the sort of mobile universe that's not really open, but you know, is based on selling material from the music industry and the Hollywood conglomerates, is that sort of the industry's way out of this to make money on this thing and maintain their intellectual property rights?
So I'd say the single largest threat to the network information economy, as it was up until now, is the expanding role of smartphones. It's an enormous opportunity for a variety of things, but an enormous threat for the other. And let me explain why. The internet is based on TCP/IP, its core protocol, which is an open protocol. The core idea behind TCP/IP is no one in the center of the network gets to control how your application works. Everything is done at the edges, on your PC, on your Linux box, on your Mac. As long as whoever the application developer is knows how to translate whatever they're doing into the simplest form of it's a packet, It knows how to send an address, and it knows how to talk to all other packets and routers. It can go over the Internet. That means that a weird company like Skype with three Estonian programmers and a Dutch and Danish entrepreneur can turn around and say, you know what, we have a good idea for how to do voice over IP, even without quality of service. All of the traditional telco companies says, you can't do it. These guys from the periphery say, I can do it. They don't have to ask permission from anyone. They develop it, and we have Skype. I'm talking to you from Skype now. It turns out that it works. So the problem, so that's the tradition that comes from the Internet. It runs over pipes historically of common carrier that are open. With mobile, from the start, we have proprietary networks using proprietary protocols that are different from each other, each with its own devices that, again, have proprietary platforms. So the history is a controlled history relative to the open history. Now, Apple has been very smart about opening their developer, their application developer interfaces to actually get a lot more contributions from app developers than they did the first time around when they did the Mac.
Mm-hmm.
Google obviously is opening up Android in order to get some of those additions. And yet, what we're seeing is that the more we're moving in this direction, the more controlled the systems are. For all of these reasons, this is a much more attractive space for the content providers. For all of these reasons, this is a space that I think we need to worry about if it becomes really the primary space in which we communicate, because it is a space that is easier to control, it's much more well-behaved, much safer, and therefore much less creative.
Our guest today on Media Matters, you've just been listening to, is Professor Yochai Benkler from the Harvard Law School, author of The Wealth of Networks by Yale University Press a couple of years back, and one of the leading experts on the Internet in the world today. We welcome your phone calls on any range of issues concerning the digital communication at 333-9455, or our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. The lines are open. Professor Benkler, last week the guest we had on the program was Matthew Hindman, author of the book The Myth of Digital Democracy. And you blurbed the book, I saw, and he uses The Wealth of Networks as basically the starting point for his analysis to sort of test out, in his view, the thesis of how open the Internet is for political discourse. And his conclusions, as you know, and as our listeners who were here last week know, were that we've actually seen a concentration of successful news and political websites online that mirrors or is even worse in some respects than the concentration of traditional news media, and that the Internet in itself seems to be more is likely to promote monopoly or concentration as it is diversity, and that, using the term you just used, that there's not much of a middle class left, that it sort of wipes out the middle class and creates superstars in this massive long tail of largely ineffectual websites. And I just wanted to get your take on that.
So I think Matthew's book is a very valuable contribution to this continuous question that we have to ask ourselves, which is, what is the effect of the net online? I take issue with several of the conclusions. I think the core question we have to ask ourselves is how easy or hard it is for anyone to get their word out, to get their view out, given the platform as it is. Our baseline, we know our baseline. Our baseline is letters to the editor, which is to say there are a few thousand people, maybe tens of thousands of people, who actually have access to some relevant platform in a newspaper or a radio station or a television station. And hundreds of millions of people who literally cannot get the word out. Now, one thing that I think is became clear over the course of the last 5 or 6 years and comes out very clearly in Hindman's book is that the original fear that people raised 10 years ago of complete fragmentation, the daily me, everyone would only see their own newspaper and there'd be no sort of common issues, that's clearly false.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't get a fragmentation. At least we didn't get a fragmentation from the net. We are seeing something of a polarization and fragmentation thanks to cable news and radio, which is to say the increasing polarization of the mass media around anchors for the right in particular, and to some extent the center left in traditional mass media, but not so much on the net. But let's take an example that I thought was powerful in one of the chapters of that book, but it's enough powerful enough that we just did a study to try to tease that apart and actually have some interesting findings. So the claim, for example, in one of the chapters is that when you look at the top 70-some bloggers, they're actually more elite than the top op-ed editors when you measure it by whatever university affiliation, some other set of measures that mm-hmm. uses. And so essentially we get no replication. The problem with that is that it takes daily costs and pads it with Marcus Mulitsis's own attributes. The problem with that, of course, is that it's a site with close to 200,000 registered users, over 10,000 active users, dozens of editors, something on the in the 100 and a bit active internal managers. And so you're looking at a site that's like that and comparing it to and comparing it, say, to Glenn Reynolds and Instapundit, which is one person without even comments turned off. What we did, once we actually saw one or two of these, is that we just a few months ago finished a study looking at the left and right wings of the blogosphere. And as it turns out, if you look at the right wing of the blogosphere, you see more solo-authored blogs. You see technologies adopted that are much more one-way. Comments sometimes are turned on, sometimes are not, but users don't have blogs or diaries of their own. Much harder for somebody who is not one of the core authors to get their stuff on the first page. Whereas the left, you get a lot more that has the attributes of the daily cost. People have their own diaries, their own blogs, their stuff can come on the front page. There's some mechanism for people to find what's on the peripheral pages and put them onto the core. So essentially what we're seeing is there's no deterministic future of this. Here are the same exact technologies, the blogs, coming up 2002, 2003. The left and right adopting different social practices and even different specific technological affordances within the general domain of blogging software, so that you end up 6 or 7 years later with a quite differentiated political blogosphere, more sole authored and hierarchical on the right, more collaborative and participatory on the left. Which of these two will generalize? There's nothing technologically to determine that.
Mm-hmm. Let's go, if we can, right now, Yochai Benkler, to Google, which is sort of the now becoming the two-tongue elephant in any discussion of the internet. As I saw the statistics recently in the Wall Street Journal, Google now has 83% of the search engine business in the United States, if I'm not mistaken. And if I'm also not mistaken, that's a higher percentage of market than even John D. Rockefeller had with Standard Oil in the 100 years ago, or 125 years ago at this time. And what is your take on the importance of Google, and are there concerns you have about it? And if so, what are they?
So, Google is definitely becoming an extremely powerful player. Siva Vaidathan is just coming out now with a book, The Googleization of Everything, where he goes quite carefully one piece after another, chapter by chapter. Really quite very well done and thoughtful in terms of looking at each of the technological components and how central the company has become. I've gone away in this. I 7 or 8 years ago, when friends started worrying about Google, my sense was, look, Google was nothing. Everybody in 99, 2000 thought search was already done and taken up by Hotbot and Yahoo and AltaVista, and the market was already tipped. And nonetheless, Google came and changed. And that gave me for a long time a degree of confidence that the company though growing, wouldn't be able to exercise power. I'm a lot less sanguine about that now than I was a few years ago. I think the combination of, on one hand, the very large infrastructure investments they were able to make that are going to be extremely difficult, if not impossible, for an upstart to replicate, make its position very powerful. I think the fact that the increasing role that it plays in cloud services and web services, so that our documents, our emails, et cetera, are all stored by the company, making it that much stickier and harder for anyone else to come in and replace it. These are all reasons to think that Google is now already under relatively weaker market discipline and is going to become less and less susceptible to market discipline until some major technological perturbation. So I worry about that. I worry about the fact that the firm has such an enormous level of control over our personal email and data and browsing habits, so that it can, as a practical matter, define and describe the universe for us. All things considered, given their relative freedom, they haven't made too many obvious mistakes that you can say they've really abused their power. I think they found, with Street View in Europe, I think they found themselves stumbling because of the higher European sensitivities to these observations, and they've had to pull back a little bit there. The most concerning and disappointing thing has been their agreement with Verizon on net neutrality. They moved themselves from being the core pillar of the net neutrality coalition to being one of the core sources of its potential collapse. Very concerning that the firm is basically shifting itself to thinking that a future in mobile and in relationships with the telcos is a more stable way to extract rents than an open internet. I'd watch that particularly carefully.
Speaking of Verizon, I'd like to talk about the broadband service providers, the cable companies like Comcast on one hand, and the telephone companies, the telecom companies like AT&T and Verizon on the other hand. You discuss them in your work, and I'm going to ask something that's going to seem completely off the wall, and it's not a question that's probably ever been asked before in American media history, but if I look at internet provision in the United States, are these guys to the internet sort of like what the music companies are to digital music? What great role is AT&T or Comcast playing in providing broadband service to Americans compared to what most other industrial countries and democratic nations in the world are getting from their systems?
So in February of this year, I and some of my colleagues at the Berkman Center finished a 330-page report, one of whose, to the FCC, one of whose core findings was really the shift over the last decade with the U.S. Falling behind on penetration, particularly in the highest speeds, getting to lower speeds and higher prices than some of the more advanced countries. We had, as of that time, the highest prices in the world of all of the countries that had over 35 megabit per second service. We had the highest prices. We had the second highest prices for speeds over 10 megabits. What we're seeing is an increasing control, particularly by the cable companies, when we're looking at next-generation speeds, that is to say speeds of above 35 megabits, the telcos, the telephone companies, have it much more expensive to upgrade the fiber than cable needs to pay to upgrade to the next generation of cable, because all cable needs to do is put in new modems that bind two or three TV channels, and they can increase the speeds to 160 megabits initially and later on 320, whereas the telephone infrastructure really requires a lot more physical digging of trenches, which is vastly more expensive, so that it costs Verizon about 15 to 25 times as much per house to get to Fios than it costs Comcast or Time Warner to upgrade to DOCSIS 3.0, the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
And both sides know this. So cable is upgrading more slowly and at higher prices. AT&T and Quest have basically dropped out of next generation speeds. Verizon has stopped its Fios rollout. So that we are moving toward a universe where the cable companies have a monopoly on high speeds. And I mean monopoly, not duopoly, on really high speeds, above 35 megabits per second,
mm-hmm.
in all but perhaps 4% of the country.
Okay.
Where the telephone companies are increasingly moving toward becoming mobile phone companies with a relatively slow home broadband connection bundle, rather than telephone companies with an internet bundle. And so we're going to get even weaker competition that we've had in the last 10 years on the next generation of broadband. And what we've seen as we compare to other countries is that when you have lower competition, you have higher prices and lower quality. This is not a new theory. That lower competition results in higher prices and lower quality is not exactly a radical anti-market statement.
And that's where and if I can follow up on that, because I had a conversation not too long ago with Tim Wu, who will be a guest on the show shortly, talking about his new book. You know, he was making the same point to me, and his argument was, and I'd be interested to get your take on this, that we're seeing sort of the development then of sort of cable broadband, Comcast, Time Warner Cable, which are all monopolies in every town they're in, having monopoly franchise to broadband to the home and to businesses, wired broadband. And then the huge phone companies, AT&T, Verizon, moving into mobile communication as their primary thing, where that will be, he said AT&T is largely going to be linked up with Apple and the Hollywood conglomerates. And then he saw possibly emerging a Google-Verizon alliance, sort of they're the other half of the Bell phone monopoly. Is that what you see taking place too?
I'd say that the Google-Verizon deal from the summer certainly raises the risk that that's what will happen. It would be a mistake, I think, for Google to give up so much of the mobile space by tying mm-hmm. itself to Verizon, and I would be surprised if they really made that mistake.
And they're not doing that now, to be clear. At this point, they're playing the field with their wireless offering.
I think they are playing the field. I think AT&T made it difficult for them when they released the first Android AT&T phone in a way that all the reviews seem to describe as essentially hobbling all of the great features of Android,
mm-hmm.
and that may be, so part of the Google-Verizon deal may be a signal to AT&T that they don't want to make Google an enemy. It's very hard to tell how much of this is direct effort, how much of this is signaling, but certainly if you look at a narrow window of the last 3-4 months, that characterization of AT&T with Apple, Verizon with Google moving forward is not implausible. I think it would be too big of a mistake. I do think that you're seeing the telephone companies, for the time being at least, giving up on home broadband as a serious place where they're competing and leaving that to cable and shifting over to mobile and hoping that 4G, the next generation of mobile, will become their really big internet play, and hoping that in the next decade to 15 years, home broadband will be a backwater that won't matter, and the really interesting thing will happen in mobile broadband. And that's not impossible, and that's a real concern once we understand that these are closed proprietary systems with a much more controlled experience and form of innovation. And that's, I think, a real concern. That's where the telephone companies are going.
All of this, Yochai Benkler, and we've only got a few minutes left, and I've got other stuff I want to talk about, but I do want to get this out. I mean, all of this is presuming that the public policy, the government in this country, basically will respond primarily as it has in the past to corporate interest and will not aggressively stake out a public interest position that will set policies and regulations that will force the system to move in a more public interest direction. I mean, we don't necessarily have to go down the road you're forecasting, do we?
We don't necessarily have to. I think the politics that have been exhibited in the last 2 years have been nothing short of breathtaking to anyone that has looked at it. I think that most telling to me was the moment at which the response to the FCC's proposal, the chairman's proposal of a third way between common carrier and Title I jurisdiction. Let me just give that in 30 to 60 seconds if we have the time.
Yeah, please do.
What happened is the FCC under President Bush found that Comcast violated net neutrality as that commission had applied it. And issued an order against Comcast. Comcast challenged that order on the grounds that the FCC didn't have any jurisdiction under what's called Title I of the Communications Act. And the D.C. Circuit upheld held that, in fact, the FCC didn't have that jurisdiction. That was probably correct on the law. What the commission was trying to do in the Republican controlled FCC at the time was to create a very, very weak jurisdictional basis that would limit the FCC's power substantially. That was, as a legal matter, a very weak position, and the court basically said, no, go back and do your homework. The FCC came back and said, look, we have a much more legally robust basis in what's called Title II, which is what the 1996 Act actually gave the FCC. And that's clearly a very sound foundation based on the statute from 96. But that 96 statute also raises all sorts of concerns of excessive regulation that were being pushed not to go there. So we'll now state in advance, we'll use the good, sound legal basis, Title II, but we'll pre-commit not to do all of the things that you guys out there are worrying. We'll just use it for net neutrality and universal service. They got tremendous pushback, and in some senses the most frightening was that they got a letter from 73 Democrats as well as the Republicans telling them that they would end up in trouble with the appropriations process if they went in that direction. So even when you had a majority of Democrats who, broadly speaking, are more open to regulating the telecoms, even when you had a majority of Democrats in the House and a stronger majority in the Senate, and three Democrats on the commission, still going in that direction brought down the wrath of a majority of the Appropriations Committee. Going forward, the probability is even lower. There's an enormous power in D.C. against public interest-oriented communications policy, leveraging enormous revenue by the providers.
You okay, Bankler? We only have, I'm afraid, a few seconds left. Can I ask you in one word, on a scale of 1 to 10, where would you put the Obama White House on its commitment to doing what it had promised to do with regard to net neutrality?
Very middling at the moment.
Yochai Bankler, on that note, I want to thank you so much for taking a time out of your Sunday to join us here at Media Matters. It's been a real honor and pleasure to have you on the air with us.
It's been an enormous pleasure to talk to you.
And I want to thank Melissa Trentz, my producer, for doing her great job. Kyle Krohauf for working the board. I'm Bob McChesney. We'll be back in 167 hours with John Nichols talking about the money and media complex in our elections. I'm Bob McChesney. Everyone have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
It'll be cloudy and breezy today. Expect a high around 60. And a wind from the south at 10 to 15, gusting to 25 today. Pretty much the same for the wind tonight, with a chance of showers and a low of 55. And tomorrow's wind could gust all the way up to 30, with a chance of showers and thunderstorms and a high of 67. Sun, but only 49 on Tuesday. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.